You are listening to Cultivating Indigenous Voices from KXEI Tucson, hosted and produced by Tina Andrew. Today's guest, I have Dr. Carletta Chief, a professor and extension specialist in environmental science at the University of Arizona.
All the Tucson listeners out there, my name is Carletta Chief, and I am a professor and extension specialist in environmental science at the University of Arizona, and I'm also director of the Indigenous Resilience Center. For all the Diné listeners out there, So what I said in Diné, which is Navajo, is I said, I am bitter water, born from near the water. Mm-hmm. And my maternal grandfather is Mini Goats, and my paternal grandfather is Red Running Into the Water. So these are the four clans by which I identify myself as a Diné woman.
Thank you so much for that introduction and sharing a little bit of who you are and where you come from. So looking into the work that you do, I did see that in the fall of 2025, Dr. Carletta Chief is the inaugural recipient of the Agnes Nelms Hari Endowed Professorship in Indigenous Resilience. In recognition of her extraordinary contributions to the fields of hydrology, Indigenous resilience, environmental justice, and climate change outreach and research. So can you talk a little bit about maybe where it all began? Because you talk a lot about why you got into the work that you do, and it's super valid why you do what you do. Can you just share a little bit of what that is?
Sure. So I'm originally from the Navajo Nation, which is one of the largest reservation in the United States, located up in Northern Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. And my community is called Black Mesa, and it's a community that's been really impacted by coal mining. So we actually live within the Peabody coal leasehold area. So I grew up there just, you know, being a res kid and being isolated. And, you know, back then we didn't have technology available to us. And just pretty much really grew up humble, remote beginnings, and just really close to my family and to my grandmothers and grandfathers. And so I grew up speaking my language, which is Diné, and learning about what it is to just grow up on the res, you know, herding sheep, gardening, or growing corn and squash, and just res life out there. So yeah, so it's pretty isolated. I don't come from a family that went to college, and my family was pretty much stay close to home, and we focused on our livelihoods. And I just have a really great upbringing. Like, I just have really great memories of my grandparents and then seeing the monsoons come in and just playing outside, herding sheep, just like long, endless, beautiful days, and just being with family. So I really treasure those times. But yeah, I came from the Navajo Nation.
Which is interesting because your work is universal with all the things that you talk about when it comes to water, when it comes to climate, when it comes to preserving. Is there one main focus that you have throughout your work that's your lifelong work?
Yeah, so I think the main theme for what drives me in my work is what we say in Diné, basically the concept of returning home and being able to give back to your people and your community. And so that really drives what I do, because I really want to support students and people with opportunities to give back to their communities, because I really feel like our people are beautiful. We have solutions. We have our land, our culture, our language, and anything I can do to support that philosophy of coming home really drives what I do.
I found online as I was watching various videos that you talked on, and you talked about how your family lived within the a leasehold area for the mining, and that you grew up seeing the mine, seeing the water contamination happen in the washes, and seeing all this environmental degradation around you. Has anything changed for the better when it comes to those issues? Because I know for years, many people have spread awareness and talked about these issues with the mine.
It hasn't changed very much. I think the major change is that we don't see open pit mines anymore in the area because the mine has closed down. But prior to that, you could see huge, like 4 or 5 story pits with coal, and then you're always constantly trying to drive around these pits. And sometimes, like, I remember when I was like in my 20s, I was coming home, I couldn't find my home because there were new roads, and I was just like driving around all these pits, just trying to find my family's house. So I think that's the major thing that has changed, is like you don't see the pits anymore. You don't see, like, you don't hear the explosions, you don't hear the machines, or you don't see like the fire and the smoke, but you still see all the mounds and the areas that were disturbed. And it's a really stark contrast that's also very sad, because you know what was there before. You remember like the rich coniferous juniper forest, all the beauty of the rocks and the animals. And now it's just like flat, like red, broken up gravel that's like has no life to it. So it's really hard to see. And my community is still fighting for a just transition because they pretty much lost a lot and have nothing to show for it. Right now, Peabody Coal Company is leaving the area. They're involved in reclamation. And so they're tearing down a lot of the infrastructure that is there. Like, they're planning on removing roads, removing buildings, even water systems. And so the community's asking, like, what are you going to leave for us once you leave? Like, how can we benefit from all this mining? So right now it's just trying to transition, trying to advocate for good reclamation and not letting the mine get away with minimal reclamation. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you're supposed to return the land back to what it used to be. So in a way that's like, you know, very idealistic and good. But then on the other hand, they're also tearing down infrastructure that they couldn't leave. They could leave for the people to use, like the water, the electricity. But right now, it's just a real hard thing to navigate because the Navajo Nation doesn't have a plan for how that will work. And apparently, they've never gone through something like this, and they've never had a successful way to transition. So the community was trying to advocate to retain one of the buildings that belonged to the mine to turn it into a community resilience hub. And even that didn't happen because there are just so many bureaucratic barriers around it. So it's just an ongoing challenge. And just seems like in that situation, the people still don't have a voice.
Wow. Unfortunately, those red tapes that are keeping things as they have always been with little change and moving forward, and folks who can help make those good changes and learning from these experiences when it comes to making a plan, having a plan. I hope that definitely is something that works out, and that there can be some type of moving forward from this long time mining situation. Another thing, I was interested in your work. You work with students and you provide mentorship or guidance in hands-on learning experiences for students. Can you talk more about that work that you do with students?
Sure. Yeah. So I work with a range of different types of students. For my initial appointment as an extension specialist, I wasn't set out to work with students. Most of my work is in the communities as an extension person. But through that work, I began to recruit students to work with me in their research and also just to get experience working in the community. And so I can serve anything from being a mentor or being a supervisor for like an internship, and then all the way to like being a PhD advisor for like a dissertation or a master's thesis, or being on a committee. So those are the ranges of things that I do. But the funnest part of my job is working with students and working with their communities or with tribal communities. So I work with both Indigenous students and non-Indigenous students. And for Indigenous students, I really want to support their work with their communities. For non-Indigenous students, I train them on how to work with tribes. So it's about a lot of ethical and professional aspects of working with tribes that requires training on how to act, like having cultural humility, being respectful, listening, just a whole like cultural change. Because when you're not native and you go into tribal community, it's like totally different cultural protocols. And for many non-Indigenous people, they're not used to that. They're used to talking over each other or trying to state their case or doing things that may not be the norm in tribal communities. So I just help them work through that and try to learn some of the ethics. And one of the ways we do that is we promote the four R's, which is respect, reciprocity, relationship, and relevance. And these are R's that are used in a lot of different communities, academic and non, that demonstrate the values in working with Indigenous communities. So it's a lot of different immersions and different ways to teach students on how to work with tribal communities.
That's awesome. An amazing work that you do with tribal and non-tribal folks. And that's important too. There needs to be somebody to teach that understanding and working, having a two-way working relationship with tribal communities, super important. And is this something that's still happening with the mobile off-grid water treatment system? And since that started, how has that grown?
Yeah, so we do have a program that is focusing on designing off-grid water treatment units. And it actually came out of Indigifuse as a way to do the training of students on not only learning about the food, energy, water nexus, but how to do that type of work in tribal communities. So we centered around this concept of off-grid food, energy, water systems. So the food would be greenhouses, and then the water are these off-grid water treatment systems. And then they were all powered by solar. So the idea was if you're living in a remote area, you can get clean water by using this water treatment system that's powered by solar, so you don't have to be connected to electricity or to the grid. And then it could power a greenhouse where you could grow local food. And then the brine or the wastewater that's coming off of the water system could be used to grow food. So it was like this holistic system that we developed. And it was a teaching tool. We did a lot of co-design. And it's also stemming off a lot of the work that Vicky Carnicola did for her PhD work. And so we built greenhouses with Diné College and with tribal farmers. And we also designed different prototypes of this water system. And they evolved over time. The first prototype was this large system that could supply water for about 3 to 5 families. And then during the pandemic, the Navajo Nation Council reached out to us and they said, hey, can you design a system just for the home? Because we're all isolating right now. We're all inside our homes. We don't want people to be sharing across, you know, different households. So can you just develop a small unit just for one house? So we said, okay. And so we downscaled it all and we worked with Six Rural Solutions and the PV Warriors. They're like young people that do solar installations. We worked with them and we designed a whole new system. And that was 2020-21, around that time we did a whole nother prototype. And since that time, it's been evolving and we've had different prototypes. And we're still piloting it in the communities, mainly because it takes time, because every community is different and we're working with specific families. And the families are actually the designer, because they tell us, like, this doesn't work. You need to put insulation here. It looks too complicated. We need something simple. And now Dr. Carnicola is collaborating with Dig Deep, which is an NGO that provides water. They're a water provisioner. And working with their system where they install a sink in the home, combine it with their sink to put the water treatment unit with that sink. So it's much more clean, it's insulated, it's user-friendly. And it takes a lot of conversations, you know, working with different communities. You want to build that trust, you want to get feedback, and we want to make sure that the design is something that they would like to have in their community.
Wow, that's awesome. I mean, thank you so much for that update. And that families are a big, big part of the success of these different prototypes and this ongoing help when it comes to having water in the home. And speaking of water, I also did see in another video where you talked about the Little Colorado River. And I just thought that was interesting with tribal members of the Navajo Nation when you mentioned about not having access to that water, even though it runs through your lands, as you're facing like drought and water shortages. I guess explaining that part of like the history of water, what is the future of having sustainable water look like for the Navajo Nation?
Well, I think sustainable water usage in tribal communities is already ahead of the curve because we don't use a lot of water already. And then we just have a different perspective about water. Water is sacred and we use it for all things. And we don't see water like in the sense of you're just using it, you're flushing it, or you're keeping your faucet on for long periods of time. We really see water as a precious living entity. And so despite all that, water access in tribal communities is a huge issue, even in this day and age in the United States. There are people that don't have access to running water. And for the Navajo Nation, it's estimated that 40% of the people don't have running water. So it's common if you go visit there that you have to use an outhouse, or if somebody does have a cistern, then they're still hauling water from someplace. And so the biggest challenge is that for the Navajo Nation, they're still working on their water rights and defining their water rights. And there are tribes in Arizona that are still in that same situation, that they're still fighting for their water rights. And for the Navajo Nation, they've been working on this for like 50 years. It's been a long time and it's very political. And so time has gone on and people still don't have water. So right now, I'm glad to say that there has been progress in on that front. The Navajo Nation, the Yavapai Apache and the Hopi tribe have come together and they have proposed a water rights settlement called the Northern Arizona Indian Water Rights Settlement. So there's a lot of political hurdles that they have to go through to come up with a package. And so they're trying to get it through Congress. And hopefully if it does get passed and President Trump signs it, that will open a way for a lot of people within these three tribes to get water, because they'll get funding to build water infrastructure. And particularly for the Navajo and Hopi tribes, they would like to build water pipelines that will access water from the Colorado River and create water distribution systems that will go down to remote regions and have spurts that go out to different villages and communities. So they'll finally have running water and they won't have to be hauling water.
Thank you so much for that shared information. Super important for many, many people to know the facts and exactly what is happening and what that looks like for the Navajo Nation. So thank you so much for sharing that. You know, time is just flying already. Here we are getting closer to the end of the interview, but there's still one more topic I want to talk about, just because this is recent. And for me, climate change is really what caught my attention when it came to getting my higher education in the field of STEM, learning all about water and sustainability and conservation and what does that look like for my own community. And even now, although I'm not in the work of STEM, I am now an observer of what has been happening on my own lands, Atam Jyotga. And one thing that I've seen in the span of just 5 years, because normally with climate change, that's what we learned back then in like 2014, 2012, it was all about this 2 degrees Celsius. And there's just a lot of things happening right now with climate. When I was a student back then, I didn't think that it was going to happen in my lifetime. And it really is happening at a rapid pace. And one thing I've noticed within this region is that in the past 7 years on the Thonautam Nation, we've had major flooding incidences happening. And because of flashes of rain happening, the ground is oversaturated, which is causing flooding over roads in certain areas. There are moments where traffic had to get rerouted. We had the big fire that happened on Kitt Peak, and then we had the big snow that we got throughout Tucson, even into the Thonautam Nation on the mountains. And usually we don't see those types of weather activity in such a small amount of time, but we're seeing it more often. And one thing that recently happened, just in September, was the tornado that touched down in near Montezuma Creek, Utah, in September of just this year, and several homes were destroyed. Thankfully, no injuries. And I would say that could be a sign of climate change as well. What are your thoughts about that when we talk about climate change? Would you say that is a sign of climate change?
Yes, I definitely would agree to that. I mean, we're seeing extreme events that we haven't seen on a regular basis now happening more and more frequently. We have haboobs, we have flooding, we have prolonged droughts, and we're in a mega drought right now. So climate change is happening, and now we have to quickly figure out ways to adapt and be able to be perseverant and resilient to these major impacts that we're seeing. Unfortunately, we're on this trajectory of climate change, and what we could do to address it is really look at our own individual practices. We can make a difference as one person: recycle, reuse, reduce, and then think of sustainable ways to effectively and efficiently use water, grow foods locally, and reduce energy use. And so I think as we see more and more of these climate change impacts happening, we're going to have to quickly make these adjustments and really work with our communities to address them. So I think, you know, even at the town level, village level, or city level, you know, some of the infrastructure that used to withstand some of these events like floods or even the droughts, they have to be redesigned, because you're just saying that, you know, some roads flooded out. So what are some new infrastructure that will prevent flooding in the future? So the types of storms that we're used to, like 50-year storms or 100-year storms, are now like 5-year storms and 10-year storms. So really intense, short bursts that we're not used to. And we have to be able to work as a community to plan and adjust for the impacts and live sustainably.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights on all the work that you've done and on the topic of climate change. And as we're closing out this interview, do you have any last comments or even shout outs that you would like to share?
Yeah, I'd like to do a shout out to the Howery Program in Social Environmental Justice at the University of Arizona, who recently awarded me with the Endowed Professorship in Indigenous Resilience. And I'm just really humbled and honored to receive this endowed professorship. I never dreamt of having such a position, and it's just so wonderful and a huge honor for me to have this award and to be able to focus on resilience in Indigenous communities. And also, it's exciting because there are very, very few endowed professorships in environment such as this particular one that's focused on Indigenous communities. So it's really great that the University of Arizona created this position. And so thank you to Howery. I really appreciate it. Ahiehet.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to come here and be with us today at KXEI.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are listening to Cultivating Indigenous Voices from KXEI Tucson, hosted and produced by Tina Andrew, featuring Dr. Carletta Chief, a professor and extension specialist in environmental science at the University of Arizona. To hear other episodes, go to kxei.org.